ancestors. Good morning, Mr. Keisler.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Peter Keisler on behalf of the defendant appellants. The defendants in this case were sentenced to terms of imprisonment as responsible corporate officers on a supervisory liability theory, specifically that their company violated the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act by shipping eggs that were adulterated, and that the defendants had positions in the company that would have given them the power to prevent that violation had they known about it. The government didn't seek a term of imprisonment in this case. Judge Bennett imposed one nonetheless, and he rejected the claim that imprisonment is an unconstitutional sentence for a supervisory liability offense. That determination was contrary to every appellate court decision to address the issue. Four appellate courts have addressed the issue: the 11th Circuit and the Supreme Courts of Minnesota and Pennsylvania and Georgia. And all of them have held that it violates principles of due process to sentence a term of imprisonment for a supervisory liability offense.
What principle of due process? Is this a substantive due process right?
It is, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has held that due process, substantive due process, protects those rights and liberties that are deeply rooted in the nation's traditions and history. And there are two sets of principles here that are extremely deeply rooted. The first is, in the Supreme Court's words in Morissette and Alonis, what it called the ancient requirement that guilt is personal, that criminal liability flows from the concurrence of an evil-meaning mind with an evil-doing hand, and that this is what the Court has called the central thought of our criminal law jurisprudence.
Sort of personal blameworthiness.
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't we have a finding by the District Court of that here, though? I mean, I understand the statute may not have a mens rea requirement, but he went on to say that the evidence was they knew or should have known. And
he does, Your Honor. He does.
So is this really the case you want it to be?
Well, that is the government's argument.
I mean, you want it to be a corporate, you know, responsible corporate officer, strict liability situation. But given the court's findings, is that really what this case is?
Let me address directly the court's findings, because it is important to be clear on what the court did and didn't find. The court.
Can I throw in one other thing? If
sure.
You address that. Isn't there a sort of a lurking Apprendi issue that wasn't appealed?
We did not appeal the Apprendi issue, so we have waived any challenge to the fact that the court made findings of fact on a preponderance. Our position that those findings don't remotely get past the due process problem, because what the district court called relevant participation and knowledge, and what the government says is sufficient that you can ignore the responsible corporate officer issues that are presented here, is nothing like any recognized criminal law standard. It was a tort law standard. To be specific, what the district court found was that the defendants had reason to know and did know that there was an increased risk of salmonella, and that they did not take all the steps that they knew were available to them in order to address that risk. That's a tort law simple negligence standard. You didn't do everything you could have done to address a known risk.
But that's more than strict liability.
It is, but this isn't only a strict liability case. The strict liability cases are cases where the defendant personally committed the offensive act. Statutory rape is the classic example. No consciousness of wrongdoing, not knowing the defendant, the other party was underage, you're liable. This is something different. This is vicarious liability. This is supervisory liability for the strict liability offense of another. And that's where the courts have drawn the lines. The courts have said that strict liability offenses, like statutory rape, can be subject to terms of imprisonment. But all the cases, the ones I mentioned earlier, all of them uniformly hold that a supervisory liability offense cannot be the basis for a term of imprisonment, and there are no appellate decisions the other way. And while the United States Supreme Court hasn't addressed the issue, Justice Cardozo, when he was sitting on the New York Court of Appeals, very pointedly questioned whether any supervisory liability offense could permissibly result in imprisonment, and the Supreme Court cited, without reaching the issue, that discussion in its decision in Staples. So to get back, Your Honor, to the district court's findings here, in order to find a criminal level of intent, even the lowest level of intent, that would be criminal negligence or criminal recklessness, those require a finding of a gross departure from the standard of care. The district court made no finding of any standard of care, much less a gross departure from that, and he couldn't have because he said specifically at the sentencing hearing, and this is page 222 of the government appendix, that he was not going to rely on any of the expert submissions from either side in sentencing the defendants. And if you don't rely on any expert submissions from either side, you can't make a finding of a standard of care, a gross departure of which is necessary to find criminal negligence or criminal recklessness. So what Judge Bennett did instead was he faulted the defendants for not taking all the steps that Judge Bennett thought they should have taken. And he specifically made the mistaken assertion that Quality Egg didn't do everything in Iowa that it did in Maine. Now, we've separately demonstrated, we think, in our reply brief, pages 26 to 30, that there was absolutely no support for the finding that they did not do in Iowa what they did in Maine. But even if one assumes there was support in the record for that, that provides no basis for finding a gross departure from an unarticulated standard of care, because the question would then be, is the difference between what was done in Iowa and what Judge Bennett thought should have been done, does that constitute criminal negligence or criminal recklessness? And there were no findings made that could have supported either level of intent. But there is also a second and separately dispositive problem with the sentence below, which is that the district court also didn't find that any of the acts or omissions that he faulted the defendants before caused the outbreak that was the subject of this crime. And that was hotly disputed in the record. The government stipulated that its expert could not testify that even if all the measures that she recommended had been strictly adhered to, there wouldn't have been the same salmonella outbreak. And our expert, in his report, explained that his conclusion based on the necropsies on the birds was that this outbreak was not connected to the things that the district court faulted the DeCosters for. It was connected to the failures in the implementation of a separate vaccination program, which left the birds on the farm with immune systems that were severely compromised. Now, the district court didn't resolve that issue, and we're, of course, not asking this court to resolve the issue. Our point is that in the absence of any finding of a connection between the litany of failings that the court identified and the particular outbreak here, it's entirely possible that the defendants are being incarcerated for an incident that none of the measures they're being faulted for not taking would have prevented. Absent a causal connection, all the district court found, and this was how he framed it, was that the risk level was here and there were measures they could have taken that they didn't take to reduce it to here. Now, that
does that argument run to the duration of the sentence or the implementation of the sentence?
It relates to the decision to sentence them to a term of imprisonment. We don't, as Justice Cardozo said in the Sheffield Farms case, monetary fines as criminal penalties, criminal convictions, those don't present the same due process issues. But the Supreme Court said in the Zadvydas case that freedom from imprisonment lies at the heart of the liberty the Due Process Clause protects, and the Supreme Court has therefore established heightened constitutional protections in several contexts when the sentence is imprisonment as opposed to any lesser criminal sentence, even for the same offense and for the same conduct.
You're relying purely on the Due Process Clauses.
Well, we also make an Eighth Amendment argument as well, Your Honor, but I will say that the core of the right that we're asserting has generally been analyzed under the Due Process Clause. That's what the other appellate decisions I cited said. That's what this court has said in United States versus Enochs and Holdridge versus United States. The question of whether a sentence is permissible in light of limited moral culpability has always been treated as a due process question.
Let me ask you, I think your argument is that this statute imposes strict vicarious liability, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But under Park, as I read it, a responsible corporate officer is liable if he's in a position to prevent something and fails to do so. Are those the same thing?
They really are, Your Honor. To talk about vicarious liability, for example, Supreme Court in Meyer versus Holly addressed the meaning of that term in the civil context. It was a Fair Housing Act case. The plaintiff had sued not only the company, but the president of the company. And the court said, that's vicarious liability. And the plaintiff said, well, the president had the power to control his employees, so he had the power to present this, exactly in the same sense that the DeCosters are said to have the power to prevent it here. And Justice Breyer, for unanimous court, said that's vicarious liability. In the civil context, the general rule is that the corporation, but not its owners or officers, are vicariously liable for the acts of the employees and the company. So what the government...
Vicarious, but is it strict liability?
Well, it's vicarious liability for the strict liability offense of another. It's doubly distant from what we normally think of as criminal culpability. Because under this statute, nobody needs to show knowledge. And the government's position is, and that's correct, this is a strict liability statute. So when you layer on top of that a vicarious liability of a supervisor who may have, as in this instance, many, many facilities, many employees, any of whom are strictly liable for any of the many provisions of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and then anybody who has the technical power to prevent the violation, if he or she knew about it, is then vicariously liable for all of those offenses. That kind of vicarious liability is permissible in the regulatory context, and sometimes if a state wants to make that a subject of a tort suit, there can be damages. But when we're talking about incarcerating someone as a criminal, a different standard needs to apply. And the breadth of this, I think, is shown, Your Honor, by the government's brief. If you look on page 57, they say this is not vicarious liability. The DeCosters are being punished for their role in the outbreak. But then they go on to say that the role they're talking about was their obligation to, quote, ensure that the company didn't violate the law. Specifically, they say the DeCosters had to, quote, take whatever steps are necessary to ensure that the company doesn't violate the law. There is no daylight between that and vicarious liability for the acts of the company.
All right. It seems to me that your argument in part is that, almost using tort principles, that he has to set up a standard and then measure it against the standard. It seems to me what to get here, to get criminal, you know, punishment, prison, you have to have some level of blameworthiness, which seems to me is a little different than a tort standard of, you know, the duty of care. And here, wasn't there, you know, again, there's this lurking Apprendi issue, but wasn't there a subsequent finding that they knew about increased salmonella infections and didn't take steps to do anything? Whether that it meets a tort standard or not, there's a level of blameworthiness here, at least a finding of that.
But I would say, Your Honor, not a level of blameworthiness of the level that has ever been considered sufficient to support a term of imprisonment, because Your Honor is right. They knew that there were environmental salmonella tests, which is not at all uncommon at these facilities. They didn't, as the district court wrongly stated, ignore the problem. It was stipulated by the government that they took a number of measures to implement it. They were cleaning the houses between flocks. They were vaccinating. They were changing the animal feed. They were doing a variety of things which didn't turn out to be effective in preventing the outbreak.
Can I throw one other thing into that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Blameworthiness, and that is condoning, at least arguably condoning, the bribery of FDA officials.
I understand that, Your Honor. And with respect to the bribery, the district court was very specific that neither of the defendants knew about any of the bribery or other acts of misconduct when it happened. The district court did fault them for not taking aggressive enough disciplinary action after the fact. But what you have here is a catalog over a five-year period that the government has assembled of all of the deficiencies and misconduct that happened anywhere at Quality Egg, including with virtually all of them, no finding of knowledge on behalf of these defendants. And a catalog of the deficiencies of the company, where and whether and to what extent it followed good or bad operating practices, for that matter, whether and to what extent the defendants were good managers or even good or bad people. When that's not connected causally to the outbreak that is the subject of the specific crime charged here, which is shipping adulterated eggs, and when it's not assessed against any articulated...
It starts to sound to me like a tort theory as opposed to a criminal theory, that there's got to be this causal connection.
Well, I think there does have to be a causal connection. The statute says that if you ship adulterated eggs or cause them to be shipped, and if there's going to be a five-year catalog of what's gone wrong here, it can't just be that because 3 years ago an employee made an inaccurate presentation to an auditor that means that the head of the company can be imprisoned 2 years later for a specific outbreak. There does have to be a link. There is a string of alleged and in some cases findings of fact of violations. The bribery, but that doesn't necessarily justify imprisonment for this crime. And just to take the bribery example, Your Honor, there was an employee who pled guilty to bribery and was sentenced for it. The DeCostas weren't charged with a bribery. They couldn't have been. There was no evidence that they even knew about it. If they couldn't have been charged with the bribery and imprisoned for that, we don't see how they can be imprisoned for a completely separate offense that the bribery didn't itself contribute to, and that they no more knew about or participated in than they did with respect to the bribery.
What about the pre-sentence report? And you're addressing the issues in that.
Yes, well, the district court adopted some of the findings of the pre-sentence report and didn't adopt others. And his conclusion at the end was, first of all, that the defendants had no knowledge of any of the acts of misconduct, the bribery, and the other issues that had arisen at the company in the prior several years. And that's on page 203 to 204 of the government appendix, when the district court says, I am not finding knowledge by the defendants on any of that. And he rejected the pre-sentence report implicitly insofar as it made other findings. And the only thing that he found relevant, and this is on page 41 of the addendum, 41 of his opinion, was that they knew of the risk and they didn't take what Judge Bennett believed would have been sufficient steps to address that risk. And when Your Honor refers to the tort standard, I am faulting the decision below for relying on a tort standard. Really a simple negligence standard. You didn't do what you could have done to fill the gap between the classic supervisory liability crime, which is what this really is, and his determination that these defendants could be sentenced to imprisonment. The government says you don't need to think about the responsible corporate officer doctrine because there was more here. And our point is simply that when that more is simply a simple negligence standard under tort law, even if it's blameworthy in the kind of sense that civil and regulatory sanctions can be applied to, it does not reach the level of blameworthiness that even the lowest level of criminal intent, criminal negligence, would be satisfied. Because even that lowest level intent requires an assessment of what is the standard of care and how grossly did this depart from it. And nothing like that was done below.
Well, doesn't that argument again run to the issue of the length of the sentence and not the sentence at all?
Well, we would say that any term of imprisonment of any length would be impermissible under the Due Process Clause.
Are you abandoning your Eighth Amendment?
We are not, Your Honor. We made this as a Fifth Amendment argument because we saw that as the constitutional provision that most directly addresses and has been used to address these kinds of issues. But we absolutely think that there is an Eighth Amendment violation here
as
well.
If you're not, how do we deal with Albright versus Oliver, where the Supreme Court has said if there's any specific constitutional protection, then abandon the more generalized notion of substantive due process, and it must guide the analysis.
The government does rely on that. They rely in particular on the case of Graham versus Connor. What Graham versus Connor said is you do not expand the scope of substantive due process under the Due Process Clause beyond what its core has always been when there is another constitutional provision, in that case the Fourth Amendment, that addresses the issue specifically. But it also said, in County of Sacramento versus Lewis, that you don't contract it either. And the Due Process Clause, at least as old as the 1910 Supreme Court decision in Shevlin Carpenter versus Minnesota, this Court's decision in Holdridge and Enochs, the four other appellate court decisions that I mentioned at the outset from the 11th Circuit and the Supreme Courts of Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and Georgia, all of them addressed the claim that a sentence is inappropriate for a limited blameworthiness offense under the Due Process Clause.
Whatever the circuits say, the Supreme Court sort of takes the leading edge. So,
but the Supreme Court has likewise addressed this as a due process issue, and what it says is you don't contract, in County of Sacramento versus Lewis, anything that lies at the core of the Due Process Clause you still address as a due process issue. Because, of course, a government action can violate two constitutional provisions at the same time. In the marriage cases last year, supposedly.
I'll reread Lewis.
Okay.
You better let the government have a little chance here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sandberg.
May it please the Court, Jeff Sandberg for the United States of America, and I'm joined here today by Lisa Hsiao from the DOJ Consumer Protection Branch and Mike Verone from the Food and Drug Administration. The defendants here admit that they are guilty of a crime and that they should be punished for that crime, and the only question before you is the nature and the severity of the punishment that should be imposed. And that is an Eighth Amendment question. As Albright v. Oliver itself makes clear, even when you're talking about a deprivation of liberty, you look to another constitutional provision if there's a more specific one. On Albright v. Oliver, it was a fractured Supreme Court decision, but seven justices agreed that if you're claiming that you were unlawfully arrested without probable cause, that that is actionable under the Fourth Amendment and not under substantive due process. So the principle of Graham v. Connor, Albright v. Oliver, and County of Sacramento applies with full force here. This is an Eighth Amendment question.
If we follow the Eighth Amendment's guide, then we would be authorized to cut the sentence, the incarceration, down to, say, 1 day or 6 hours or something like that, if we thought that deprivation of your liberty without mens rea or without knowledge of the criminal act needs some punishment of some sort or needs none. Or we could say down to zero, right?
Well, of course, that question isn't presented here, Your Honor, because as the district court found and as defendants do not dispute, they knew that they had widespread salmonella contamination in the environment of their facilities. They knew subjectively that that resulted in an increased risk of salmonella contamination in the eggs themselves. These two defendants made decisions.
But they're not opposed to a hefty fine, for instance, are they? They're here because we have a sentence of 3 months in jail.
That's right. And so the question is, in this case, taking these facts that were found in the sentencing record by the district judge, whether it would be grossly disproportionate for these two individuals to have a short jail sentence of 3 months. And it would not be grossly disproportionate here. They subjectively knew there was an increased risk of contamination to their eggs. Jack and Peter DeCosta were heavily involved in the operation of the facilities. They decided when to test, what to do in response to the tests, and when to move flocks between facilities. Peter DeCosta for...
My question to you is that if we think that 3 months in jail is grossly disproportionate to this crime, then we could wipe out the criminal sentence under the Eighth Amendment rubric.
If you were to conclude, and it would be extraordinary to conclude because this court has said it has never, never invalidated a term of years, or in this case term of months, sentence that's within both the guidelines and the term authorized by Congress. In fact, this court has occasionally said that it's generally not even reviewable under the Eighth Amendment if the sentence is within both the guidelines and the term authorized by Congress.
It's almost unheard of putting corporate officers in jail for a criminal act that they didn't know anything about, isn't it?
I would submit that that is not this case, Your Honor. In this case, Jack and Peter DeCosta had operational control over the facilities. They knew that there was widespread salmonella contamination. The pre-sentence report and the government's expert report contains a lot of detail on this, and my opposing colleague said that the trial judge didn't look to the expert reports. I don't have the same reading of the record. Certainly, the expert reports are discussed in the pre-sentence report, all of which was adopted as a finding of fact by the district court, except to the extent that provisions were disputed, and most of the pre-sentence report is undisputed here.
But by a preponderance of the evidence in the pre-sentence report as instead of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
That's right. But as my opposing colleague correctly conceded, they agreed to be sentenced by a preponderance, and there's no Apprendi issue in this case.
You want it limited to the Eighth Amendment, right? Have other courts analyzed these sort of questions under substantive due process?
There have been some. I would agree that some of the state court constitutional decisions are analyzed that way. But
isn't it sort of a fundamental principle of our law going way back that you can't put someone in jail who doesn't have a bad mens rea?
No, there are many strict liability crimes that exist, and the Supreme Court has found that several of them that provide for many years imprisonment are strict liability offenses, such as possession of sulfuric acid under circumstances where it's not lawful.
For the acts of others?
This is not about the acts of others, Your Honor. So all of the cases that my opposing, if I may.
If you look at the statute alone, it certainly would allow it. I mean, that's part of my concern, is it seems to me troubling to allow the government. Maybe that's not this case, but to condone a strict liability for the acts of others and put someone in prison, that That, it just doesn't sit right with me.
Well, numerous courts over the years have imposed terms of imprisonment in responsible corporate officer cases. I would agree with you that with the premise that that is not this case. It's easy in this case to understand that it was these defendants' mistaken judgment that is at issue here. The cases that they rely on, the 11th Circuit case and the three state court cases, rest on the principle that a man's liberty should not rest on so frail a reed as another man's mistaken judgment. Well, the relevant mistakes in judgment here are theirs. Peter DeCoster decided to transfer new flocks into barns that he knew had already tested positive for salmonella. And the industry standard for many years in the egg industry, and this went undisputed below, is that if you know that a barn has tested positive for salmonella, your next step is to figure out, are the eggs themselves positive, and you test the eggs, or alternatively, you can divert the eggs for pasteurization and sale as liquid egg product, and you make a little bit less money that way. But that's what responsible egg producers do, and they did not do that here.
This evidence, again, is coming from the pre-sentence report, right?
Yes, yes, yes. It's the vast majority of the facts of this case are undisputed. They knew they had widespread salmonella contamination in the environment of their facilities. They knew subjectively that that translated into an increased risk, which sounds very much like recklessness to me. If you have a subjective awareness that your actions are resulting in a greatly increased risk to others, the FDA estimated, after it came in and conducted its inspection, it estimated that the rate of salmonella contamination in their eggs was 40 times higher than their previously assessed national baseline. So it's not even close to.
District court didn't find recklessness. At most, it said knew or should have known, right?
The district court found that they had relevant knowledge of conduct related to the contamination. The district court did not use the word recklessness. But another point I want to make on this is that there's no requirement that the district court have found that it was at least a gross deviation or even recklessness. There are federal crimes that carry an ordinary negligence standard. Three circuits have held that the Clean Water Act, a discharge carries not a strict liability standard, but an ordinary negligence standard. And even Morissette, the case relied on by my opposing colleague about the concurrence of an evil-doing hand and an evil-meaning mind, drops a footnote to say that there are some cases that carry a negligence standard. So the model penal code is not part of federal law.
Has the government ever prosecuted the upper officers of a packing company one of their plants has distributed a hamburger with salmonella and caused medical problems and put them in jail for something that happened down in the packing plant?
I don't know specifically about packing cases, Your Honor, but I can point you to a couple of examples of cases
there's more salmonella spread around the United States in those kind of instances, I think, than eggs. Maybe that's wrong.
I think that eggs are the leading source of salmonella enteritidis contamination. It's a particular type of salmonella at issue here, and it's more and more the way that eggs get the salmonella in them is not because it's coming in through the outside of the shell. It's because the organs of the salmonella-laying hens are infected, and so they lay infected eggs. And the reason that the hens are infected is because there are rodents running all over their feed, defecating in the feed, and the hens are eating their feed, and they're eating salmonella, and there's 10,000 organisms per rodent dropping. So one of the real failings in this case was even if they take an air compressor and blow the dust out in between flocks, which the government concedes they did dry cleaning, that's what that is. If you don't fix the rodent contamination problem, and their own pest control expert, who they eventually brought in very late, said they had an ungodly amount of mice, you're going to constantly recontaminate your facilities over and over.
Well, you're sort of between the devil and the deep blue sea on this because the way to do this is to cage the hens and catch the eggs and handle it that way. And the people that oppose that say we ought to have free-range chickens, and when you have the free range, you're going to have rodents and that sort of thing. So you're proposing then to put the officers of the company who maybe do not police keeping the rodents out of the free range and so forth in jail. I can understand if you gave them a hefty fine, but I agree with Judge Grunder, this idea of being your liberties being deprived without a mens rea is a tough nut to swallow.
Happily, the court doesn't have to address that question in this case if it doesn't want to, because here the district court has assembled a fulsome record of the knowing disregard of public health and safety by these particular two defendants. The government understands that farms are dirty places and that you can only do so much.
Not all of them. Just
right. Well, responsible egg producers will do what it takes to minimize the risk. They will put safety above profit. These defendants did not take the safeguards that undisputedly are part of the industry standard in this area.
Are there any cases where courts imposed a prison sentence under similar facts?
Yes. I can point you to just a few. They're on pages 41 to 43 of our brief and also on footnote 10. But to give you just a few examples, there's a Third Circuit case in which the president of a company was held liable and imprisoned for 3 months, same sentence as here, for shipping rotten eggs. And the defendant there argued that jail sentence would be inappropriate, in fact, unconstitutional, because he didn't have a mens rea, because he didn't know that the eggs were rotten. And the Third Circuit said, no, the statute provides for strict liability. And I don't believe an Eighth Amendment challenge was brought there, but the Court of Appeals upheld the three-month conviction. To give you another one.
Did they analyze it under substantive due process?
I don't think so, Your Honor. So one thing to keep in mind on due process is that many defendants will argue that I'm not actually guilty of a crime because I didn't have a bad mental state and the crime carries a mental state. And that is a due process inquiry. And that's we've addressed that some in our brief. That's the Staples case from the Supreme Court. That's the Morissette case. And one of the inquiries in figuring out whether the crime carries an intent term is whether the penalties for that crime would be relatively small. And anything under a year, the Supreme Court has held, and this court has held repeatedly, is relatively small. But in this case, they're not arguing that they're not liable. They're admitting they're liable. The question is only the severity of the punishment. And that's an Eighth Amendment inquiry and not a due process inquiry. But if they had come in and said, we're not guilty of this crime because we didn't know that the eggs were contaminated, then you would conduct the, the Staples-type inquiry, although the Supreme Court has actually settled several times over the question as to whether this statute provides for strict liability. And the Supreme Court has said on at least one occasion that there's no constitutional infirmity in making food distributors the strictest censors of their merchandise. I want to point out as well, the government has multiple enforcement tools at its disposal here. So the same violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is also actionable civilly. And FDA can exercises its discretion in choosing what cases to recommend to the Justice Department. The Justice Department exercises its discretion in choosing what cases to bring to the court. The court exercises its sound discretion in deciding how to sentence someone for a crime. And if the district court sentences someone in a way that the appellate court finds contrary to law, the appellate court can review that. Here, we're looking at a three-month sentence that was imposed by the district court. And the district court said, I don't even think a year on these facts, and given the background of these defendants, and in particular Jack DeCoster's multiple, at least one prior federal conviction, and then there was another a fine in Maine before. I can't remember how that was characterized. But the district court is very familiar with the DeCoster family now, and it said, I don't think Jack DeCoster is someone who's learned from his mistakes before. And it's those kinds of factual judgments that are, of course, subject to appropriate deference by this court on appeal.
So let me ask this. Let's say an Apprendi argument had carried the day, and there were no factual findings over and above the flat-out guilty plea to a responsible corporate officer theory based on acts of others. Would you be here defending a prison sentence?
I don't think there would be an Apprendi violation because I don't think that there's – of course, Apprendi is normally a rule of you're not allowed to exceed a statutory maximum unless certain facts are found. And here the statutory is 12.
None of the facts were found, the later facts. It's based solely on the plea.
Well, this court – if this court were to hold that there's a problem there, it would be the very first to do so. And if you look at the cases cited on pages 41 to 43 of our brief, I just mentioned the Greenbaum one, which was the Third Circuit rotten eggs case, but there's also – you know, the Second Circuit underweight butter case in which a company president got 6 months for selling misbranded butter because it misidentified the quantity on there. And there's the Lellis case in which a company president was sentenced to 18 months because it was a second offense and therefore a felony.
So based solely on the acts of others and based on the fact that a person is in a responsible position in a corporation, it's okay
to go to jail. So my opposing colleague, I think, may have led you astray in characterizing this as vicarious liability because the Supreme Court in Park is very clear that it is the failure of the defendant who is before the court to exercise his duty to take the necessary measures to protect against shipping contaminated food in interstate commerce. That causes the violation. This is not about holding someone liable for a mistaken judgment made by someone else. And they admitted at their guilty plea, Your Honor, that they were the people with the authority and the responsibility to prevent, detect, and correct the sale of the adulterated eggs. It is not as though someone unbeknownst to them or against their orders decided to ship contaminated eggs. That's not what happened here. To be sure, there are some acts in the record here that do concern acts by other people and about which they didn't have contemporaneous knowledge, or at least the government couldn't prove it. But the district court did find that the DeCosters presided over a culture of rampant safety violations, and each of those safety violations, bribing federal officials, putting the wrong dates on eggs, hiding eggs from the federal officials so they wouldn't be found, those acts actually increased the risk that salmonella would be in the eggs that the American public eats, because defective eggs that are cracked and leaking, it's easier for salmonella to get inside of them.
Okay, do you want to make a summary statement?
Just if there are no further questions, Your Honor, we would ask that the sentences be affirmed.
I'll give you 2 minutes to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, counsel for the United States said he reads the record differently on whether the district court relied on the experts. This is from the sentencing transcript, the court. But you know, I'm not going to base any sentencing decision based on the experts. I actually don't know even why you submitted all those pages of reports. I read them all. I studied them, but it actually has no bearing on my sentence. And then he says, but you think I'm really going to determine whether somebody goes to prison or not, which is the fighting issue in this case, based on what any of the three experts said. And that's important because you cannot have a finding either of a standard of care and criminal negligence or recklessness, or of a causal connection between the particular deficiencies alleged here and the outbreak without relying on some expert testimony. It can't be something based on the district judge's intuition. Second, with respect to the Eighth Amendment, Fifth Amendment question, Judge Beam, even if Your Honor addresses this under the Eighth Amendment, ultimately our claim that the reduced level of moral blameworthiness and the absence of criminal intent and personal participation renders a sentence of imprisonment unconstitutional has to be addressed under one provision or another. That's the core of the merits argument here. And if Your Honor does address it under the Eighth Amendment, it remains the same argument. It remains as strong. It still has to be addressed. And when one looks at the issue of proportionality or disproportionality, it is vanishingly tiny, the number of cases in which judges sentenced to terms of imprisonment on responsible corporate officer offenses, and that's because they understand what constitutionally treacherous territory is, such that in United States versus Park, the Supreme Court's last decision on this, the government hastened to tell the court when the court said, could this be an imprisonment case? The government said, imprisonment isn't at issue here. This is just a $250 fine. Therefore, you do not need to resolve what government counsel told the Supreme Court was that difficult situation. Now, with respect, Judge Grunder, to whether this has anything more than the responsible corporate officer case, it certainly doesn't have anything more that fits any recognized standard of criminal liability. Counsel for the United States said...
Do you want to finish the sentence?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Counsel for the United States says it sure looks like recklessness to him. This is not a know-it-when-you-see-it standard. There is an accepted standard for criminal recklessness which wasn't met on the findings here. I thank the court.
Thank you all for your arguments. This is certainly raises many complex issues that we'll spend some time on. That completes our oral arguments for today, and we'll be in recess.